Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man I believe really has distinguished himself for his courage, his vision, and particularly his willingness to sound the alarm about what is happening within his faith community, namely the Islamic faith, about the jihad, stealthy and violent, in every platform he can find, including earlier today on Fox News. He is our first guest. He is Dr. Zudi Jasser, a physician by training, a former naval officer, a man who has founded and is the president of a marvelous organization, the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, a leader in the fight against Islamism, the stealth jihad, most especially within the Muslim community here in the United States, and an exponent for freedom around the world. Dr. Jasser, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Frank. Thanks for having me on.
Always a pleasure. You were speaking on Fox earlier today about something that is, it seems to me, just another example of what the civilization jihadists of the Muslim Brotherhood are up to. A mosque being built with taxpayer money in the airport in Orlando. What's going on with that?
Yeah, it's just fascinating that, you know, sort of what's driving this appears to be Orlando has now a contract with Emirates Airlines that's going to have a direct flight to Dubai from Orlando, and it seems that they're going to coincide the beginning of that direct flight with the opening of what they're calling a recitation room, but actually is a for Muslims only. And, you know, as an American, and also as somebody who's focused on anti-Islamism, I look at a relatively small airport in the scheme of things that doesn't have, like JFK, a place for Catholic worship, Protestant, Jewish worship, but all they had was an interfaith place, and now they're going to have a Muslim place of worship. They're not calling it a mosque, but it's close to it, being funded to the tune of $250,000 of taxpayer money in Florida just to appease the Emirates Airlines. Now, they'll call it a business decision. They interviewed Imam Musri, who's a Muslim Brotherhood advocate, has raised money for Hamas and others, who says now is the time for Muslims to realize that we have rights and the victimization post 9/11 is going away. I mean, this should show that airport the harm they're doing. And, you know, I travel a lot and I've used prayer halls in airports. I'm not saying they shouldn't exist, but they should exist equal for all faiths as interfaith facilities and not just for Muslims.
I guess what makes this so important and your voice so valued in these matters, Dr. Jasser, is that you appreciate the kind of incremental stratagem that's being applied here. One of the other places where we're watching this take place is, of course, in mosques around the United States, not in airports necessarily, but in other parts of the country, with an organization known as the North American Islamic Trust, or NAIT, a Muslim Brotherhood-tied organization, buying up mosques' mortgages or creating them, you know, in the first instance. What role is NAIT playing and these mosques under its control in, well, that same Islamic supremacist agenda here in our country?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You know, if you ask them and when they get confronted, the Islamic, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood Islamists will say, oh, we have nothing to do with them. They just sort of hold title indeed. And then you look at the books and apparently upwards of 30-40% of mosques in America give their deed over to the North American Islamic Trust. And not only is their origin from Muslim Brotherhood origins with the MSA and others of that tree that was planted in the 60s and now controls so many of the mosques, but what it does is it centralizes the authority and control so that they can affiliate themselves with Islamist ideologues around the country. And thus, anti-Islamists could never really get a voice in these mosques because the deed in trust and the economic flow, if you will, of money is through Islamist ideological organizations that, as we saw in the Holy Land Foundation trial and others, expose that a lot of these sympathetic Islamist organizations travel in the same streams. So thus, that's the problem with it. It's not like NAIT is sitting in Indianapolis or wherever they're headquartered and controlling the streams directly, but it certainly is, as we see politically or religiously, common sources, no different than leftist organizations that will fund common organizations. Islamist organizations will fund and control these common ideologues and mosques all over the country, and we see it here in Phoenix and elsewhere.
I'm told that the funding for NAIT is actually a line item in the Muslim World League out of the government of Saudi Arabia's budget, interestingly enough, and that the numbers may be far higher than 40%. I've heard numbers as high as 80% of the mosques around the United States now have NAIT controlling both their mortgages, their financing, and obviously their activities. Let me ask you about something else. You mentioned the Holy Land Foundation trial. One of the most important things to come out of that, aside from the conviction of five co-conspirators for material support for Hamas and terrorist organization, as you know, Zudi Jasser, was something called the Explanatory Memorandum on the General Strategic Goal of the Group in North America. It has been described as a kind of strategic plan of the Muslim Brotherhood for, quote, destroying Western civilization from within by their hands, meaning ours, in the hands of the believers, so that God's religion is made victorious over all other religions. To the extent that this has been a very important insight into what the Muslim Brotherhood is about, an effort's being made recently by a fellow by the name of David Shipler, a former New York Times journalist, to essentially try to dismiss this document, both its sort of authentic character and also its import. You've studied closely the Brotherhood and what it's up to from inside the Muslim community. Do you believe that this is a genuine reflection of its ambitions and a document that we should take very much to heart?
You know, I can't tell you how frustrating it is to read. You know, it's like you think that we, not only did government documents go uncontested through years of not only the case, but then appeal and finally victory and conviction of those board members of the Holy Land Foundation, but that document has withstood tons of connections and verifications that it's real. And then ideologically, anyone who understands Sayyid Qutb understands Hassan al-Banna's mission through the Muslim Brotherhood, and then Maududi through the Indo-Pakistani connection, and all the Islamist ideologues knows that this is what they do. They see freedom and liberty as an anathema to Islamist state, the Sharia state, if you will, and they will try to influence the West to prevent our foreign policy from allowing their ascendancy and their neo-caliphate, otherwise known as the OIC. And it's amazing how people, it's so important for our anti-jihadist groups to come together and continue. You know, when we did that documentary, The Third Jihad, that was based on the explanatory memorandum, we were castigated by the liberal media. The New York Times repeatedly dismissed it as Islamophobic, as they call it, and ignored the fact that it was narrated by me, a devout Muslim. And now a few years goes by, it still stands, and millions have seen that documentary. The facts have never been disputed, and yet now Shipler comes out and is trying to rewrite history. And if you look, this is happening in America, where they exploit the fact that Americans are ignorant about Islamism. You go to countries like Malaysia, Saudi Arabia, OIC countries, and Muslims by the millions are struggling to defeat Islamism, and no one doubts what the mission of the Brotherhood is, as the Egyptians went through the street to defeat it. So it's so bizarre that in the land of freedom, where we should understand this, we're rewriting history by Islamist propagandists aided by Shipler and the New York Times, while we sit back and look at the Islamists that are actually being pushed back in Muslim-majority countries in this struggle for modernity.
It is incredible. And but for your efforts, Dr. Zudi Jasser, I think we'd be a lot further down the tubes than we are. Dr. Jasser is also a founder of the American Islamic Leadership Coalition, a very important umbrella group of anti-Islamist Muslims who are doing, really, I believe, the Lord's work. You are also, of course, the driving force behind a terrific organization in Phoenix, American Islamic Forum for Democracy. I hope people will look for it at AIFdemocracy.org. Check it out. Support Dr. Jasser's important work. We ran out of time, Zudi, to talk about your recent travels in East Asia. I hope you'll come back to us again soon to talk about what's happening with the Islamists there and what it portends for our interests in the region and beyond. Keep up the great work, my friend, and thank you for finding a few minutes with us to talk about it today. Next up, we'll talk with Diana West about women in combat, Donald Trump, and much more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined as we have the high privilege of being each week by Diana West, a syndicated columnist for many years now, a blogger par excellence at dianawest.net, also the author of two extraordinary and best-selling books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. Diana, welcome. As always, great to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank. Wonderful to be with you.
You have been following very closely for a long time, Diana, problems in the American conduct of the campaign against the various jihadists, notably, not exclusively, but notably in Afghanistan. Just today, there were two more losses in what has come to be known as green-on-blue attacks, two NATO personnel killed by individuals wearing Afghan uniforms, presumably Taliban, or at least people wanting to get right with the Taliban. They too were killed, apparently, in the attack. What should we be thinking about as we hear more of this kind of conduct going on, both with respect to Afghanistan and frankly, the war against these characters more generally?
Well, you didn't mention the third thing, which is my first concern, which is what these coalitions mean in terms of our own leadership, in terms of our own strategy. We've seen this green on blue. I hate the phrase, the insider attack, all of these euphemisms that can't possibly convey this horror of people inside the wire wearing uniforms that are supposed to be allies, turning around and shooting you, us. And this has become normalized. This is part of what you can expect along with, foreign international diseases from a certain area of the world, or difficulty in the sun or the heat or the weight of the pack. This is part of the threat package that we accept in trying to work as allies with Islamic countries, fighting jihad with many people who believe in jihad. And that's sort of the very basis of these attacks.
We're visiting with Diana West, one of my favorite people, who has really mightily contributed to our understanding of kind of the threat environment in which we're operating. We're talking, Diana, a bit about how we've seen normalized, in a way, this kind of real and present danger to our personnel, and to us more generally, really, from a jihadist threat we're not properly understanding, let alone countering. Continue that thought, if you would.
Yes, well, the notion we're normalizing the threat to our first and always in our incubator of the military, and then we see us normalizing the same threat with the importation of large blocks from the Islamic world. I think of Germany this week, where we saw rioting, violent rioting. Many people died, something like 10 people were killed, among them some Germans and some immigrants, over a torn Quran. And you think, maybe that should be a question on the immigrant checklist. If you react to a torn Quran by killing people and breaking things and burning cars and attacking police, maybe you shouldn't be admitted into our country in large blocks or in any number. But this notion that we are normalizing both insider attacks on our troops in the Afghanistan example, which has just gone on too long. I mean, this is insane. And we are, as a matter of immigration policy or lack thereof, doing the same thing by importing blocks from the Islamic world, where people predictably will have these same instincts that come out of Islam.
We're talking about some 800,000 of these folks turning up now in Germany this year alone, I'm told. And in other parts of the world, there is also a serious push being made, as you know, Diana West, to bring them to this country. Some have in Congress, I call it the Jihad Caucus in the United States Senate, have insisted on some 65,000 Syrians, most of whom would be Muslims, and people the FBI say they cannot vet. So probably some of them are of the jihadist mindset. When you hear people like Donald Trump inveighing against our immigration policies, are you struck, as I am, by how basically sensible many of the things, if not all of the things, many of the things he's saying, and certainly the policy and program he's laid out? And are you also struck by the wild, over-the-top attacks to which he's being subjected, not just by people on the left, sort of the usual suspects, or Islamists, for that matter, but by people on the right as well?
Yes, in fact. Yes, in fact, both those reactions I feel very strongly. I think that what we are both reacting to is, this is an interesting thing to say vis-a-vis Donald Trump, but is the normalcy of his reaction to a crisis. He reacts, even though he is an extraordinary human being that is in a category by himself for all manner of reasons, he is reacting like a normal person would react to the loss of a border, to the invasion by alien hordes, to this destruction of America as a sovereign nation. And I think that what we see happening, we see other normal people, which does not include hardly any journalist I can think of, with a couple of strong exceptions, of course. We are seeing normal people say, thank you, yes, I agree, finally someone can do something about this, because I think what he conveys is, besides the sort of normal reaction, the reality check, if you will, to the Washington establishment of left and right, is also a can-do attitude that I think it defies the political system. And I think that those two items alone probably account for much of his support. And then when you layer on the establishment left and right, particularly right, trying to essentially assassinate his political career before it even gets started, with crazy rules about, you know, participation in the primaries and the invective that just is, I've never seen anything like it, I think it only adds to his loyalty of his followers.
Diana, let me, before we run out of time, turn to another topic on which you've given a lot of thought and written, I think, very eloquently. And that is, in this week where we're marking the first two female Rangers in the United States Army, to warn against this notion that somehow this justifies, let alone ought to be the catalyst for, the integration of women into the ground combat ranks. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, very succinctly, my thoughts on that is when women fight, civilization loses. And in our upside-down, topsy-turvy, Brave New World, when women fight, we are supposed to cheer for equality and for the opportunities that have just been opened up for women. To me, this is just another nail, a very significant, it's maybe not a nail in the coffin, it's putting the lid down on the whole notion of the role women play in culture, have traditionally played in culture as the guardians of culture, as the bearer of children. I mean, to erase these thoughts of womanhood, if you will, from what is supposed to be possible, from what is supposed to be, again, normal, this to me is a sign of civilizational decline. And it's very sad that it is not, the whole discussion is not even part of the argument, and indeed has been essentially conditioned out of everyone. We mostly will discuss this in terms of efficacy, efficiency, troop cohesion, things that are important, but things that only really get around the edges of the tremendous civilizational shift that this reflects.
Diana West, this is one of the reasons why we cherish our time with you each week, is you have a perspective on our culture and our civilization that is really necessary, a corrective to much of what passes for informed thought on these matters, whether it has to do directly with the military or more broadly with our constitutional republic, for that matter. And we appreciate your time each week. Thank you for joining us on this occasion. We'll look forward to talking with you next week. We'll speak with Dr. Harold Rode straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. It's been apparent for some time that the Obama administration will say anything to implement its disastrous nuclear deal with Iran. For example, the president has claimed it closes all pathways to an Iranian nuclear weapon. As Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer has noted, that's not so. Team Obama asserts we know about everything that Iran's secretive program has done in closed sights. As former Clinton Director of Central Intelligence James Woolsey has written, that's not true. The president insists his deal is the only way to avoid war with Iran. Democratic Senator Bob Menendez disagrees. Now, administration spokesmen are signaling that the deal will provide useful targeting information for a future attack on Iran's nuclear program, instead of making it effectively impossible. Is there really a Democrat or anybody else who buys that fraud? Stop the Obama bomb deal. This is Frank Gaffney. Learn more at irantruth.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Dr. Harold Rode, one of the smartest men I've ever encountered on matters involving the Middle East. Today he writes for the Gatestone Institute, but for many years he was a senior advisor in the U.S. Department of Defense about the Middle East in general, Iran, Turkey most especially, and we're going to talk with him about recent developments on both of those fronts. We catch up with him in the State of Israel. Harold, it is always good to talk with you. Thank you for finding a few minutes for us.
Same here, Frank, and thanks so much for the compliment.
Most welcome and most deserved. Let me talk first about the Iran deal. Harold, in your several decades in the Department of Defense, you saw a lot of thrashing around about Middle East policy, about various peacemaking initiatives, arms control agreements, and the like. I ask you, have you ever seen anything quite like what is being served up now in terms of this Iran, I call it the Obama bomb deal?
Never have I seen anything like this. This is American capitulation, or shall we say the Obama administration's capitulation. We get nothing out of this deal. And if you look at the way the administration tries to sell it, it's weak when something else is exposed, which is terrible. They come up with, well, we at least get this, or we at least get that. And it's a constant withdrawal. And the question is, will a minority of people in Congress and Senate be able to make sure that the president gets what he wants? Which, again, is capitulation.
It's a travesty in that regard. But let me ask you, because you, again, have lived amidst and deeply understand the mentality of the sorts of people we're dealing with here. Most immediately, of course, the Iranians themselves, but others in the region as well. When this kind of display of American weakness, irresolution, capitulation, as you put it, is in evidence, Harold Rode, what does that do to a regime like that of Iran? What does it translate into, in your estimation, for others in the region, notably the Saudis, the Gulf Coordinating Council, and so on?
The Middle Easterners go with the strong horse. They respect power. America is showing that it is an unreliable ally, and and the result is that people are looking for cover. There's nobody in this region that I know of who supports this deal, including most of the Iranians. But if America is not going to stand up for its traditional allies in this region, which are the Saudis, the other people in the Gulf, and the Israelis, and the Egyptians, then these people have no other possibility than to give in to the Iranians. Now, the Israelis obviously have a different view, but America can start in weakness. But it's not only here. The Chinese, vis-a-vis the Chinese, it's the same. All over Asia, that America is simply, has America gone crazy? People have asked me. I've heard this from Indians, I've heard this from Japanese, and I've never heard anything so direct.
Yeah, they're clearly concerned as well as bemused. Harold Rode, when you talk about this situation of now a minority of members of Congress, in this case, a partisan minority at that, and probably just in one house of the United States Congress, foisting on all of us this very, very defective agreement, it reminds me a little bit of another polity that is undergoing a similar kind of perversion of the democratic process. Another country with which you are very familiar, in fact, one of the country's leading experts, Turkey. Talk a little bit about what President Erdogan is up to at the moment.
Erdogan is an Islamic dictator. It's that simple. Now, his party in the Turkish parliament did not get the number of seats they needed, so Erdogan can change the constitution where he can concentrate all power in his hands. The opposition has the votes to put together a government right now. It involves three parties. They may not like each other, but they hate Erdogan worse. Now, these people together can put together a majority government, but Erdogan won't let them. And he, therefore, is demanding that there be new elections in Turkey where he hopes to be able to get the majority that he wants to basically declare himself sultan, meaning that all power will be concentrated in his hands. This is dictatorship. This isn't democracy. And just like the minority of people who are going to be able to force this Iran agreement on the United States, if it continues as it appears now, then we see the same thing going on in Turkey. Turkey used to be a democratic ally of the United States, but it seems like that Erdogan is nothing more than another tin pot dictator in the Middle East.
But with a strong Islamist coloration to him, which makes this much worse. Harold Rode, let me ask you, when you look at what has happened lately, we've not had a chance to visit, I don't think, since this deal was struck between the Obama administration and Erdogan that enables us at last to use American equipment and personnel based at Incirlik to help wage the war against the Islamic State and putatively to get other Turkish help in that regard. What has been the price we've paid for that, do you think? Has it had something to do with Erdogan's current domestic operations as well?
Frankly, I don't know. But what I do know is the whole operation against the Islamic State is a sham. They want to know, the Middle Easterners here, are we going to destroy it? We can effectively do that. These people in the Islamic State, ISIS, ISIL, whatever you wish to call it, these people travel in open convoys throughout the desert, and we can pick them off easily if we want to. But it doesn't appear that we're serious. Again, we're demonstrating weakness. We, therefore, with our, oh, I'm sorry, I can't do anything attitude, or wringing our hands, are going to make sure that these people, the bad guys, take over all these places. Is that really what is in America's interest?
Harold, talk a bit about what's being done by the Turks against the Kurds at the moment. Is it just this Communist Workers Party, the PKK, that they're going after, or is it the Kurds more generally? And what are the implications of that for, you know, the future course of this conflict in Syria and for that matter, the Islamic State?
There are two ways of understanding the Kurdish problem. First of all, Erdogan tried to get the Kurds to vote with him so he could again become dictator. When they refused, he tried to bring them into the system. But when they refused, he said, well, there's another party. These are the extreme nationalists, the extreme Turkish nationalists. And if I go against the Kurds, they will love me and they'll vote for me instead in the next election that he plans to have, instead of the Kurdish party that they voted for now. So that is why he's doing terrible things, not just Kurdish Workers Party, but to the Kurds in general. After trying to bring them into the system, now he's doing awful things to them. But what he is also doing is strengthening the Kurdish identity. That's by default. I'm sure that is not his goal. I don't think he cares one bit about the Kurds. I don't even think he cares about the Turks. He cares about himself as to be dictator. Now, what saddens me, Frank, and I'm candid, is that Erdogan has been in power since 2002. This was already the Bush Jr. administration. And the State Department, other people, did their damnedest to prove or to say, oh, he's not an Islamist. He's not a bad guy. He's not that. We can work with him. Well, that's like talking about moderate Nazis. It's absurd. And so it's, frankly, it's not just the Obama administration, but I, from my own experience in the previous administration, the administration really didn't stand up against Erdogan. And it was very clear, if you followed who and what he was in the past, that he was an Islamist.
Was an Islamist, is an Islamist, will be an Islamist, and what he is about is not in our interest. Harold Rode, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. Thank you for your extraordinary service to our country over the years at the Department of Defense, and that you're rendering now as a senior fellow of the Gatestone Institute. You can check out Harold's superb work at gatestone.org. Harold, keep it up, my friend, and come back to us again very soon. Next up, former special operator Jim Henson joins us with an important new salvo from the retired military community against the Obama bomb deal. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by my colleague Jim Henson, now the Executive Vice President of the Center for Security Policy, a former weapons sergeant in the United States Army's Green Beret, a man who has worked very assiduously on many different fronts in this war for the free world, both in uniform and now in civvies, and we're always delighted to have him with us for his insights into, well, what I think of as kind of the boots on the ground perspective on this war for the free world, but also more broadly, the work that you're doing now with us at the center. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Frank.
Well, one of the big developments in the debate about the Obama bomb deal is a letter that was released today from something well north of 150 flag and general officers now retired from the United States Armed Forces. They have weighed in very, very strongly against this deal, in contrast to an earlier letter sent by a much smaller number that had supported it. Jim, talk a little bit about the letter and the importance you think it might have in this debate.
Well, Frank, I can tell you one thing. It is rare to get that many general and flag officers to agree on what time of day it is, let alone something as important as this. So the simple fact that they all formed ranks and decided to put their names behind something telling Congress that they don't believe this deal, A, does what the president says it does, and B, makes us one lick safer, and actually, in their words, makes us much less safe. They point out some of the same things that our experts have, that this deal does not stop enrichment, as opposed to actually stopping all paths to a nuclear bomb, as President Obama said. This does pave the path to a bomb and almost surely leads us to war. So it's a powerful message, one that I think should resonate with the American people when they're, you know, the cream of their military leadership tells them that this is a bad idea.
Well, it's, of course, not, unfortunately, the case that it just has to resonate with the American people. They seem to be getting this by overwhelming numbers, of course. According to the polls, Jim Henson, it's a question of whether that small clique of Democrats in the House or Senate, or perhaps both, will heed the president's insistence that they follow partisan considerations rather than national interest in supporting him on this deal. We'll be watching that closely, as I know will you. Jim, let me switch gears. I want to talk with you a little bit about this attack that took place last Friday in France on a high-speed train. Some of your former comrades in arms were instrumental in preventing it from being a massacre on the train, in subduing the perpetrator, one Ayub El Kazani. It seems now, after much hand-wringing and deflection of the point, that this guy was actually a jihadist. Surprise, surprise. And that he had in mind an act of individual jihad. Premeditated individual jihad. Why is it, Jim, that we seem to still find this so hard to get our head around that that's what we're up against?
You know, I don't know at what point, and this goes quite a ways back, a decision or a bifurcation was made between people who can look at a group and a wide-ranging and diverse group, but a group of people who have sworn themselves to the destruction of anyone who doesn't share their religion. And another group of people who look at that same group and refuse to connect the dots and will do anything they can to euphemize away the fact that these people share one common characteristic. They believe that Islam must dominate the world, and they're willing to kill anybody who disagrees with them. And I can see just a glimmer of an idea why not wanting to pin that on Islam so that you don't alienate billions of people worldwide or a billion and a half or whatever it is, but you cannot deny the reality of it. And by doing so, point out to anyone that you're not willing to actually name the threat you're facing. The people who are innocent Muslims who are not attempting to kill everyone in the world, they know these people are Islamic. So it's comical for people who are not even a part of this to stand on the outside like President Obama and claim that ISIS is not Islamic. They are. They just happen to be horrendous, destructive individuals trying to perpetrate, you know, that the crime of Islamist supremacy.
Well, of course, it would be comical if it weren't so deadly serious. Jim, let me ask you about something else that has been in the news lately, and that is that Boko Haram, the terrorist Islamic jihadist supremacist group out of Nigeria, has now begun sending its fighters into Libya. Remind us how it is that Libya got into such a state where we now are seeing Boko Haram there and what they are promising to do from that vantage point.
Well, that was one of Hillary Clinton's and Barack Obama's finest moments. I believe that was the genesis of leading from behind. If I recall correctly, that was the first time that phrase came into common usage, when they decided to go ahead and essentially assist the jihadists who were overthrowing Gaddafi. Now, Gaddafi, horrible human being, one of the worst. But he's a guy we talked out of nuclear weapons by threat, not by giving him $150 billion a signing bonus like we're doing to the Iranians and everything else they want. We scared him into giving up his nuclear program. And Clinton
and actually did give it up.
Yeah, he did give it up, as opposed to the Iranians who will not. But Obama and Clinton, you know, went ahead and created a giant mess in the aftermath of Gaddafi leading from behind. And now there are jihadist groups from all over the world. And the intercontinental caliphate, you know, it's one thing when they ran the black flag up in Iraq and Syria, that was bad enough. But when Boko Haram and other groups started swearing allegiance to the caliph, to al-Baghdadi in Iraq and Syria, that caliphate became an actual global operation, part of the global jihad movement, as we've termed it. And to have them now moving troops around the world, deploying forces as part of that global jihad against the free world, is a horrifying development and a sign that we have absolutely fundamentally failed in, again, not naming them and not fighting them properly.
Yeah. You know, we talked with Diana West earlier in the program as well, Jim, about the extent to which this refugee flow now from Turkey, notably, but also just directly across the Mediterranean from places like Libya into Europe is an opportunity for groups like the Islamic State, like Boko Haram, like other jihadists to infiltrate their operatives into Western European and other countries, including, of course, ultimately ours. Give us a sense of how serious a threat you believe that represents on top of what the French and others are already contending with at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, the open borders among the EU has been a problem because if, like you said, if millions of refugees or hundreds of thousands, it's been unprecedented, the numbers that have been entering EU countries over the past couple of years, if they can get in without being screened and all of that, and then once inside, become part of the general, you know, social welfare covered system in the EU and move around freely, then they have essentially become an ungoverned state. And they're going to find that not just the jihadis they had who got there through their legal programs, but the worst, the most deadly kind will be infiltrating regularly. And as you mentioned, that's going to happen to us as well. We've got a refugee resettlement program where the UN conspires with our State Department to pick mostly Muslim refugees who the FBI is unable to screen, and they bring those in and settle those folks in communities all over the United States and immediately, you know, start all the things we don't need happening there. So it's bad for everybody.
Of course, this is, as you know, Jim Hansen, the subject of a terrific monograph on the subject, The Refugee Resettlement and the Hijra to America, that colonization of America by Ann Corcoran. Check it out, folks. It's available for free online at securefreedom.org. Also, check out her video, which now has 1.2 million views. Ann Corcoran at YouTube. Jim Hansen at the Center for Security Policy, thank you so much for the terrific work you do. Keep it up, my friend. We'll talk with you again very soon. And we'll be joined by Gordon Chang next with his latest update on the meltdown of the Chinese stock market, what it might mean for the politics of China and for us. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where a relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Gordon Chang, our duty expert on matters involving Asia and that of Fox News, that of Forbes.com, that of WorldAffairsJournal.com is with us. I'm delighted to say thank you very much, Gordon, as always, for your time and your expertise, particularly at a moment when, as you have been observing very closely, what is happening in China is having widespread repercussions. So let's start with what's happening to the economy of China at the moment. Big stock market drops over the past few days. Is there any end in sight, and what is impelling it?
The Shanghai Composite Index, which is the widely followed measure of Chinese stocks,
has fallen for five straight days. Today, it fell only 1.3%. But this is after China's rescue package for the Chinese economy, and everyone expected a much bigger bounce up. And so clearly with the market continuing to fall, it shows a lack of confidence of the Chinese people in their leaders, in their technocrats, a loss of their credibility. And this is going to be important because the Chinese leaders have got to rescue their economy, which is tumbling. It's not growing at the 7.0% that they claim. It may not even be growing at the 2.2% that they're privately talking about in Beijing. This is a serious situation for the Communist Party.
I was listening to NPR earlier today, and one of the stories that they had was of kind of the man in the street reaction in China to what's been happening. And a lot of, well, not only grave concern, obviously, but also hostility towards the government for what was described as basically its role as kind of a booster, notably through the state-controlled media, for investing by ordinary Chinese at a moment when it was pretty apparent there was a bubble developing in the Chinese market. Are you picking that up from your sources and your own experience in Hong Kong recently?
Yes, there is a lot of anger in Chinese society right now. We saw that 4 days ago when a crowd in Shanghai detained the head of a metals exchange and turned him over to the police. The real problem, Frank, is that there would have never been this stock market bubble which started last summer if it were not for the efforts of the Chinese central government to talk up the market. There was no fundamental reason for this market to rise. It only rose because of central government boosterism. And so the inevitable happened. This was dangerous and reckless and just plain stupid, and the Communist Party is going to pay for it. That's why we're seeing more and more censorship of stock market news. People's Daily, the Communist Party's flagship publication, doesn't talk about this at all. And my friend George Chen of the South China Morning Post has been doing some wonderful reporting on his Twitter account about the censorship. This is going to be a big story going forward, of course.
It's a big story for us, too, Gordon. And you have a piece at Forbes.com about whether the Chinese have sucker-punched the Fed, as you put it. Talk a little bit about the implications of what's been happening to the Chinese stock market for not just our stock market, but actual Federal Reserve policy with respect to interest rates and perhaps more.
In the last four trading sessions, we've lost about $3 trillion of value. And that's mostly attributable to the problems in China rolling across global equity markets, first in Asia, then in Europe, and of course now in New York. The other thing, and this is the sucker punch of the Fed, China devalued its currency, the renminbi, 2 weeks ago. And its actions really don't make sense when you look at the economic rationales for it. And the only thing that I can come up with is maybe what they did was they tried to prevent the Federal Reserve from increasing interest rates, which at least about 2 weeks ago, most everybody thought would happen. But then you had the problems in China, and maybe what they're doing is they're trying to keep interest rates in the U.S. low. And the reason is because if interest rates in the U.S. rise, then you're going to see even more money come out of China. Perhaps $800 billion has left China in the last year. This is unprecedented at any time in history.
And we haven't seen the end of it, needless to say. You're watching it closely for Forbes.com, for Fox News and elsewhere, Gordon, and thank you for keeping an eye on it for us as well. Let me ask you about another story that we touched on, I think, in our last conversation, but it seems to be continuing to royal U.S.-Chinese relations. Agents of Communist China have been operating in the United States. I'm not talking about all of their intelligence operatives, of course. I'm talking about two folks who are apparently pursuing a fugitive in this country. What is the state of play with respect to that operation, and why is it being allowed to happen at all?
Beijing is maintaining what it calls Operation Fox Hunt and its Skynet initiatives to track down corrupt or supposedly corrupt Chinese officials who have fled to the U.S. Those officials are probably corrupt, but all officials in China are, and this is just a political purge and one side trying to track down its enemies. What's occurring is that the agents of the Ministry of Public Security are entering the United States
and trying to persuade these individuals to return. Now, these agents are not getting the permission from the Justice Department. So this is not spying, which a lot of people call it. This is an interference of American sovereignty, and it's got to stop. This administration has tried to cooperate with China on this. The last administration just turned its back completely and allowed the Chinese to roam the country free. So neither political party has much honor in this. But the American people have got to stop this, because this is just antithetical to all sorts of American principles. We cannot allow it to continue.
Gordon, is it a case, in your judgment, of the Chinese simply overlooking the fact that they're supposed to get permission, or did they feel emboldened to conduct such operations without permission by the way they've been handled by the Obama administration to date?
They feel emboldened. For decades, Frank, Chinese officials and agents have been allowed to monitor Chinese students on college campuses, and even worse, to organize demonstrations meant to affect American political discourse. This has occurred almost openly, and so, of course, Chinese officials thought that they could ignore the Justice Department and come in recent months to try to track down officials. So this really is an Obama administration problem, but it's really a problem in the last administration, which was even worse in terms of allowing the Chinese free roam of the U.S. So that's why I believe that there is bipartisan failure on this. At least now it's getting some attention, and the administration is starting to react.
Will these individuals be apprehended and deported if the Chinese do not do what they're supposed to in terms of seeking and obtaining permission?
The United States has not said so, but China has said that their agents were ordered to leave the U.S. So they're not being deported. They're not being apprehended, which is what they should be. They should be put on trial, and they should be put in a federal penitentiary for a very long time, hopefully for the rest of their lives. We need to do this. And if you can tell I'm angry, I am. And I'm having trouble speaking, because this is one subject that really gets me at the core, because we have allowed this to continue for so long, and it's just unacceptable. You know, the Chinese are villains, but we've permitted them to be.
Well, that's part of it, Gordon, as you say, the emboldening of them to behave that way. Lastly, and you have studied deeply on this, written a major book, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Talk about what is happening at the moment, Gordon, very quickly, if you would, between North and South Korea.
North and South Korea have come to an agreement. The South will stop propaganda broadcast into North Korea. The North Koreans expressed regret for the maiming of two South Korean soldiers in the DMZ. They were maimed because of North Korean mines.
And is that the end of it?
That's the end of this episode, but there's so many more issues that are going to continue, largely because the regime in Pyongyang is unstable, and so therefore we're going to see more incidents going forward.
It's a full employment program for you, Gordon Chang, that's for sure. That and what the Chinese are up to and more. Keep it up, my friend, at Forbes, at Fox, World Affairs Journal, and of course with us each week. We're very grateful to you for your time. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week, and the rest of you tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.